Hey guys, welcome back. This is Where We Are. Today we have a special guest. He is Carlos Lanzona. He's one of my very, very best friends from childhood and until today. So we will be probing his life a little bit. He's a competitive powerlifter and strongman. He also cooks for Grand Hyatt BGC. In this episode, we will be talking about powerlifting, the kitchen life, overcoming adversity, being focused and having genuine relationships in this life of 2018. Hit us up on Spotify, iTunes, and of course, Patreon. Links will be in the description below. Hope you enjoy this episode and see you again on the next one.
Hey, fellow listeners. So we have a special guest for today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, guys. I'm Carlos Lanzona. I'm Miguel's friend. What's happening, y'all? I just woke up and had breakfast and now we're rolling. Thinking about things to talk about.
Yeah, because usually the flow of the podcast, at least for now, is we just really want it to become very, very authentic. So that means that we really don't have much of a plan. We do have pointers, of course, that's required, but we don't have much of a plan to as what topics will concretely be. But yeah, let's go to you. What do you do?
Well, I work as a cook in the hotels, basically. I'm working at Grand Hyatt Manila, and it's my fifth hotel. At 22 years old, which I think is pretty cool. At the moment, I'm competing as a powerlifter and strongman. And I'm 5 weeks out from competition. And I try to juggle that and working 15 hours a day on my feet.
Wow. You heard that, guys. This guy is a chef / powerlifter. Can you tell me more about how you started cooking and how you got into the culinary industry?
Yeah, most of the people that go to the culinary industry or land there usually would tell you, "Now I love cooking. When I was a kid, I chopped vegetables with my mom, stuff like that." But for me, I was pretty sure would be a college dropout if I went to college.
Yeah.
When I graduated from high school, I knew that I would go nowhere at all. If I picked a course, I'm pretty sure I would flunk it, okay, even if it was like the easiest one. So I didn't do anything for 1 year, thought about it. Then I like to rummage at book sale. So I got a book, Kitchen Confidentials by Anthony Bourdain. Really nice book.
That's his first ever book that he wrote about his memoirs going around the world.
Basically, it was when people read it, it was like, shit. This is really cool. I want to be a cook. But it was a cautionary tale. Like, this is the kitchen. This is so hard. This is hardcore for gangsters. Like, you're going to die.
Yeah.
But I took it as parang
inspiration.
Yeah. I wanted to become like a rock star.
Because that's his persona that he wants to put across, right? I mean, Tony Bourdain anyway.
If I couldn't grab a guitar and rock it out, I would rock it out inside the kitchen. Yeah. Like, he talked about banging waitresses, doing lines of cocaine in the chiller.
I know, apparently outside during breaks, that's what apparently a chef thing to do, I guess.
So,
well, by the way, I'm not saying that all chefs are like this, and this is about Tony Bourdain in the US. Yeah.
So, I was inspired by the whole subculture of the kitchen, and I didn't know how to cook at all. So, I took up culinary school, but I didn't last long. It was like 8 months and I am gone. I posed as an OJT in another hotel. Then I worked my way up.
So would you like to describe yourself as a self-taught chef?
Pretty much. Because in school, they just teach you the basics. But when it boils down to it, you just have to know all the flavor profiles. If you read the menu that you need to work on for today's function, for example, sometimes you can't just know everything. So you just read what the menu is, and then you have to base on it, like flavors. You just have to know the flavors. Like if it sounds Thai-y, then you cook it like a Thai curry.
Yeah.
If it sounds Indian-y, then you cook it with an Indian flavor. Yeah, stuff like that.
You think this intuition of like knowing which goes where. For example, you said that if you're gonna make a Thai dish, you should do it the way a Thai would do or a Thai cook would do. But do you think this intuition, this intuitive intelligence is required Is this a basic need for all chefs? Because I'm pretty sure that not all chefs are as reflective or as intuitive as you when it comes to that cooking, because some really rely on menus. I mean.
You think some chefs are like mechanical, like they follow the rule as in what the recipe says.
Yes, but in the same way, it could also probably be that they are not flexible when it comes to cooking. Like, yeah. Do you think is that a need? Is that something that is a golden trait of the kitchen?
Yeah, like an edge in the kitchen.
Well, Gordon Ramsay's mentor Marco Pierre White once said that a recipe is one thing, but a method is something else. People, there are two camps for me. Two camps of cooks. I won't go to chefs yet. I consider myself a cook. Because chefs, two kinds of cook. I call them scribbly jam kids, which are the kids that have an iPad. iPad, man. iPad with the recipes on them. A notepad. Chef, 140 grams of flour, 200 grams of milk, 4 eggs. And then there are other cooks like tattooed gangsters, man.
The rock stars. So
tattooed, sleeves up, no toque, no apron.
The Marco Pierre White.
Yeah, unbuttoned shirt.
Yeah.
And just goes through the service with a hangover, with cut up arms from sharp food pans, hiding in the chiller just to wake up a little bit, and flirting with the waitresses.
Yeah.
Now, the differences between them would be the other guy, what you said, mechanical. If you throw some things at them, dynamic, for example, you run out of things, you run out of stocks, you have to still put out food, right? That means the recipes goes out the window. In my 5 years of cooking, I've never written anything down.
Wow.
The difference being is one guy has recipes down and the other guy understands the ingredients. For a recipe to work, you have to learn what an onion is, what it contributes to the dish. If you cook an onion, for example, if it's raw, it will taste like this. If it's translucent, it will be a little sweeter. If it's caramelized, if it's fried until it's dark, it has a different flavor if you add it to some soup or stocks. If you follow a recipe without knowing what your ingredients does, then you won't advance as a cook, for me. You can compile 5,000 recipes in your head, but if you don't understand your ingredients, then there's no point to it.
So to you, it's that's the gold standard. It's literally knowing the soul of the ingredients that you put across out there.
It's about knowing the ingredients and how it reacts to heat.
Yeah.
For example, if you cook tomato sauce, tomato dish, very easy, right? People would say na you chop onions, you chop garlic, put it in a pan and simmer it. If you cook garlic, it's a small detail, but it adds up. Eh? It stacks up, like attributes to a video game. If you cook garlic, slivers, and then you just fry it on a medium heat, low heat, high heat, it cooks. But when you put olive oil on it and then garlic with low heat, then when the garlic starts cooking, then you turn off the heat and let it rest for 5 minutes. The pan is still hot, right? It's residual heat, still cooking the garlic, but very, very gentle heat. That way, you soften the garlic without cooking it, getting more color to it. Soft garlic put in the tomato sauce. It's a small detail, but it adds up.
Yeah.
Things like that, recipe cooks wouldn't understand.
Wow.
Stuff like that. When adding spices to a dish, for example, you turn off the heat. You let it activate in hot oil. But the pan is still hot. Stuff like that, you can't get anywhere
else. Those little details, they really make a big difference. And, as Migs was saying about the intuitive intelligence of some cooks, I'm into like food documentaries
and
some vlogs, food vlogs. Mark Wiens, all those YouTube personalities. And based from what I would see apparently that the best cooks are like the aunts. The aunts, the grandmas. Because apparently, based from what I watch as well, they just taste things.
Yeah.
They don't follow like any standard of measurement, especially I saw an episode of, for example, of a TV show of Gordon Ramsay going to Malaysia and Vietnam. He literally cooked with aunts, and they were like just telling him, literally just taste it.
Yeah,
then just season it accordingly, and that's it. Like, that's very that's actually really interesting too.
It is like with the two camps, nga, some people would tablespoon and measure. Some people would say that. Yo, put one fist of salt in that. Like, put 3 pinches of this and that. And the intuitiveness comes with time. You see, like, if you see your aunts, your lolos, your titas, they cook really good. But it's about the accumulation of time under the heat. How long have they been cooking? How long have they been doing that dish? Then it becomes intuitive. When you're new, and you don't, you just follow recipes. You won't accumulate that intuition points.
Yeah.
Something like that. I like the Gordon Ramsay episodes. He went to India and cooked with
it. Yeah, I watched
really that. Good episode.
He tried this mango chutney that was made out of ant's eggs.
Yeah.
He went like into the middle of like an Indian desert or forest, a village.
Crazy.
Yeah.
They were cooking, I think it was goat under sand.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And he went to New Delhi, right? And he was talking about curry houses in the UK back in his home.
Yeah.
And the Indians were like saying, no, bullshit.
Bullshit.
Like, this is not how you
too
cook
sweet,
curries.
Too creamy.
Yeah. This is not legit.
Really. It's a big difference. Because when you taste real Indian food, like authentic Indian food, it's very different from how Indian fast food tastes like.
Mm.
Like English Indian food is too rich, too creamy, too buttery.
Mm.
When like, real Indian food is rich, but in the sense of flavor, not cream, spices, stuff like that.
So tell me about your the first place that you worked at. How was the experience there? And
I started working in the kitchen when I was 17.
Right.
My boss was like, "Okay, just don't tell the HR you're 17. It'll be good." It was Midas Hotel and Casino. Do you know that place?
It's along Ross Boulevard. Ross Boulevard. Yeah.
It was a nice experience. One of the chef de parties there, one of the supervisors, really liked me. He was into bands as well. Like, he's 34 and like Slipknot and Lamb of God. It is so funny.
Oh, and Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah, so I bribed him with CDs and
said,
"Oh, come in every day. Whenever he's at work, I'm gonna come in. But when he's on day off, I'm gonna take a day off as well." And then I learned a lot from him. He always kept talking about Sofitel being like, Sofitel's a great kitchen. I learned a lot there. And instead of working with him and continuing that route, I resigned and then I joined Sofitel.
Ah,
and I said, "Chef,
okay,
you told me that Sofitel's great, so I'm coming over." And then I worked in Sofitel for 2 years.
Wait, were you working there at Spirals?
Yeah. I pre-opened the new Spiral. It got destroyed by the flood, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when it was being rebuilt, I was a team on the Indian kitchen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I worked 2 years in the Indian kitchen in the Brazilian Trust Korea.
Oh, yeah,
so
the Trust
Korea.
It
was a cool experience, like cooking 50 kilos of prime rib every
Sorry,
day.
Vegans.
Sorry, vegans.
I just can't convert myself into
you
that.
You suck. And then I liked Indian food, but it wasn't a really nice career path because you go nowhere else as a specialty chef in the Philippines.
Yeah, Indian food's not really big here in the Philippines, is it?
Yeah, not big, and it doesn't have that much of a following either.
Yeah.
You can't be an Indian cook for life, right?
Tell me, what were like the growing pains or struggles initially when you started as a cook in the hotel? What were like the most memorable, like difficult moments?
Well, everything is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Up until now, man. I've been working 5 years in the kitchen, and when I get home, I sometimes cry myself to sleep. And it's that fatigue.
Yeah.
And it's that hard. If I show you my feet, you'd be run away terrified from horror.
Oh.
I get wrecked. My shoulders, my back, my feet hurts every day. I work 15 hours in the kitchen. And then when I get home, I have to commute 2 hours to work and 2 hours back home.
Mm.
And it just saps the life out of you. Hardships, it would have to be the extremely low salary.
Okay.
Extremely low salary. Yeah. I worked three years minimum wage. No overtime was paid. Shoot. And every day I worked 14 hours.
14 hours.
I worked 3 months straight with no days off. And it was okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
It the subculture of the kitchen is like harder or at par with the military. I'm not even joking. I'm serious.
Would you say that, to sum it up, would you say that it's physically stressful being a cook, or is it both of being mentally and physically stressful?
It's spiritually crushing.
Spiritually crushing.
Yeah, man.
So it's beyond.
It's beyond what we people know as labor. It's something else. Would you like to hear what one day would be like?
Yeah, go.
You get up, right? 5 a.m.?
Yeah.
You have to hurry up because you're late for work. You have to be with breakfast. You have to cook breakfast ship at 6 a.m. The restaurant opens at 6:30. Then Spiral has 600 people coming over to eat breakfast, right? So you ride the bus, go down at World Trade Center, then run to Sofitel Philippine Plaza.
So that's your cardio already. That's your warm-up.
5:45, you go up to work, right? With your chef jacket on. Your chef screams at you, "What time is it? What time is it, man?" You're going to say, "Chef, 5:45. And then he says, "You're going to be late even if you're not late. Even if you're...
So you're always late.
You're
by
always
default.
Late. You're never early. Even if you're 15 minutes early, you're still late. That's how work ethic and discipline in the kitchen is. Then let's say the service was great. You feed 600 people, no problem, no worries. Now you have to prep for the next breakfast. Let's say breakfast next to tomorrow is 800. You prep for that. And while you're prepping for that, you're thinking about lunch. How many people have to eat lunch today? You ask the receptionist, "Chef, it's 180. Then you have to prepare that. You have carving, you have vegetables, you have sides, you have whatever, you have sauces, you have... And even if you're going to prep that, you have to find your equipment. It's a big hotel. What if your food pans are missing? What if you don't have a ladle, specific wire whisk? You have to find your pots. You have to find your pans. And even then, you're still rushing. You're walking fast. You're running. You're panting. You're sweating. And while you're doing all of that, with all this chaos in your head, your chef is fucking with you. Like, "Oi, you still haven't done this. You still haven't done that. Are, Baba, why are you working like this, man?" Stuff like that.
Yeah.
"You know, if I was an Indian cook, I would not do this." Stuff like that.
Hey, that's a good accent, though.
Nah, it could be better. And yeah, it's really hard. And then let's say you're done with lunch. You're really tired. You haven't had your break yet. You're running on 3 hours of sleep. You've had 6 espresso shots. You cut your hand. You burnt your forearm in the oven. And it's still not done. You're not done.
It's so stressful that even the biggest insomniacs can go to sleep after this.
Yeah. And then you take like 3 cigarettes and that's it. That's your break.
That's your break.
Cigarettes and coffee and that's your break. You go back. You ask your chef, "Chef, what else do we need? Can I go home now?" And he said, "Going home already, Baba." And you're not going to go home. Definitely you're not going to go home. "You are to make naan do. You are to make tomato chutney. And then prepare for breakfast tomorrow."
Wait.
Yeah, man.
Yo, can I ask, how long did you master this accent?
it used to be in "I am a poo na hasa pima petalon."
Is this part of the course in the program?
Nah, please come again. It's okay. It's the only thing that carries over from being an Indian cook is that you get the accent. But everything else is trash.
Here's an interesting question. You say you've been working in the buffet section, right? Besides pissed off chefs like scolding you, are there also asshole customers?
A lot.
Can you tell me?
Can
like,
I be a little
bit
racist?
Yeah, what are the pet peeves of like,
cooks?
Your pet peeves? Yeah.
Well, Sofitel, we've had a lot of Chinese arrogant, ignorant, rude mofos, man. Basically, if I see you and you look like Chinese nationals, I'll turn your back on. I'm going to turn my back on you. Huh? Then I'm going to go away. Pet peeves. Some guests are going to eat at your buffet, right? And then look for the one that's running out. And then they're going to get that. Then you have to refill it 15 minutes before you close. And then no one's going to eat it. Then they're going to throw it away. Oh. What does... calling us waiters like, "Waiter, waiter, We don't like that. What else? Basically, when you work in a live kitchen like Sofitel Spiral is, pet peeves are the guests.
The guests.
Because the guests, all of them make irritate us. Most of them irritate us. Unless you're really hot or really handsome, then maybe you won't.
You know, is it also like a headache when you know how people, when they would stare at the dish and they would like dip their faces in the buffet and there's like, you know, I don't know, they get too close to the food before
We don't like it if you get too close to us. We don't like it if you talk to us that much. Because we didn't sign up for this to smile at you guys and
we're here to cook.
Yeah, and serve food at your table. It's not our job.
Yeah.
We didn't like, I want to be a cook so I can talk to people.
We
cook because we're demented and we don't like talking to people and we like the nightlife and we like getting drunk after shifts. We don't cook to smile at you in breakfast and please you so you can write as a Chef Carlos was really nice. He cooked me breakfast and it was great. We don't live that life.
Hey, so, what do you think of Erwan Yousaf? Is he a good cook?
Erwan Yousaf, the CrossFitter. What's up, Erwan?
Yeah, go ahead. I'd like to hear your thoughts about Erwan.
I can't hate on him because I don't know him that much. I won't follow him on Instagram and stuff. I just know that he does Spartan races in CrossFit.
Right.
Come on over. It's a strongman, Yousaf. We need you. Does he cook?
Yeah.
Does he cook?
There was a video of him cooking taho.
Taho?
Yeah. And he... search it on YouTube. Sorry about the mic nearly fell down.
Microphone.
What's this? There was a clip of him on YouTube cooking taho. And he used the wrong tofu.
Really? What did he use? Did he use like the Chinese tofu?
It's meant to be like kind of like the hard, fairly hard tofu. There's still some texture in it, but he used the really soft.
Second one. Hey, no shortcuts, Erwin.
Yeah.
What happened with the taho, if you don't mind me asking?
It looked botched when he finished it. Obviously, it was a cooking show, right? It seemed everything was fine
and all. Was this live?
It wasn't live. It was like one of his shows. You might cringe, but
he has a cooking show.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of tofu he used, but he got a lot of heat from it, from people saying, hey man, what the fuck? What's that?
At least you know that he's an intuitive cook, right?
And he used apparently the wrong tapioca. Like he didn't fully cook. He didn't fully cook the tapioca apparently, so it was like too big.
Al dente, man.
Yeah,
Italian tapioca.
Yeah. Let me ask, Migs, do you see yourself working in the kitchen?
I actually don't know.
Yeah.
Because I've never been too much informed about the kitchen, actually.
Yeah,
if it wasn't for Carlos. So most of the facts or most of the culture that I know about the kitchen is all from Carlos.
From him.
But if the difficulty is that, well, you know, I think I have this belief that this goes the same with weightlifting or with strength training because the best athletes usually have to be a little bit neurotic. They have to have a tick in the head. For example, you train every day, your lifts go up for like maybe 5 kilos or something in the span of 3 months. But you see, it's like 3 months for 5 kilos in the main lifts. Is that the life? And you get knee pain, you get shoulder pain, you can't rest, you can't even lie down well sometimes because your back hurts.
Yeah.
And it's not because of like your form is wrong, you're doing things wrong. No, it's not about that. It's more of like, you need 20, you need only 80% of, sorry, you do like 20% of the work for you to get 80% of the results. Like that's the what they call the 80-20 rule or something.
Yeah.
But if
the Pareto principle or whatever.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that's true. So you do 20% of the work, you get 80% of the reward. But 80% isn't gold medal. It isn't even silver. It isn't even bronze. But if you have the mind, if you want to be a champion, you have to do that additional 80% to get that additional 20% reward.
Mm.
So I think that the best athletes always have that mentality that doing just enough isn't enough.
I think you have to have that personality trait of being obsessive.
Yeah, with what there, you do. That's what I'm looking for. You have to be obsessive. And I for sure
while consciously knowing that there's a risk that all your work will go nowhere.
It can go nowhere.
And
it most likely will go nowhere.
Yeah.
But you still go to...
You still do it anyway. It's absurd. Yeah.
It's the same as working in the kitchen. I don't even know why I powerlift and work at the kitchen at the same time. Because everything you do doesn't matter when you get home.
Mm-mm.
Nothing, like, you would say that nothing really matters because you go late for work, you grab an Uber, you spend most of your money with transportation or stress eating. After your 15 days and you get your salary back, it's just your salary and there's nothing else.
You
run out of money.
Yeah.
At the exact time your salary comes in, every day of the month. Yeah. And with powerlifting, weightlifting, and any other strength sports, it's the same. Your lifts might go up, but it's going to balance itself out and you get hurt. Then you're going to go back to it. Then you're going to go down and you're going to go up.
So you're a competitive power lifter.
I would say yes. Yeah, definitely.
How did you start? How did you get into powerlifting?
I got into powerlifting because I was a fat, lazy ass mofo who only likes to eat and play video games. This is a really long. Would you really like to hear? I jack off, definitely.
Yeah.
Five times a week.
That's a workout frequency. Though.
when I was working at Sofia, I was around 286 pounds. Around 130 kg.
Mm-hmm.
I was really fat and I was really angry and I was really lonely. Fat and sad and mad. basically, what happened to me is what happens to everyone. I got my heart broken. And juicy!
I can, go ahead.
Juicy.
Yeah.
You can imagine?
Yeah, like I personally know people as well who went through.
I fell in love with this half Scottish crazy ass rocker chick that works at the French kitchen.
Oh,
it's kind of like rock starring Anthony Bourdain style. Then she broke my heart. I started lifting because I was thinking that she didn't like me because I'm a fat motherfucker. So I started lifting. I started running every day obsessively. I ran from Sofitel to Las Piñas every day after work. After working for 59.
Real?
For realsies.
How realsies. Many freaking kilometers is
maybe
that?
Maybe 22.
Like you literally run across the stretch of coastal road.
Coast? No, you go to the Baclaran side, then go out to Cabiasnan. Yeah, I'm going to run the coastal road. 300 cc's running.
Yo, listeners, he's bigger than Forrest Gump, yo. Forrest Gump has nothing on him, man.
Jacked Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
He even has to pay toll when he's going to pass by.
Yeah.
Sir, 24 pesos. I'm not class one.
He's that hardcore, guys.
24 pesos, sir. No, I'm only going to pay 12, man. Then I ran every day and then I lost weight, like automatically lost. I 130, I got down to 95.
Sorry to cut you. It's 12 kilometers.
12 kilometers. Nice. Yeah. I could have ran the marathons.
Yeah.
Then I coupled that with strength training.
Yeah.
Like usual 5x5 routine strength training.
Yeah.
Hillbillies do it. Then, from there I got into powerlifting. But I didn't compete until August 2016. Yeah. Then I won these two medals over here, which is just a consolation prize.
Whoa.
Because no one else was lifting in my weight class.
You were top one.
Yeah. No, top two.
Top two.
Yeah. And then it just went from there.
But can I just say, like, I mean, I'm pretty sure that you had the choice of just being, of doing just like strength training, you know, being a casual, like, quote unquote lifter, right? What made you like powerlifting?
Wait, yeah. That's what I think binds Miguel and I together as friends, is that both of us have this do or do not Yoda attitude. We don't go half-assed. We never go 1/4 power. We always full charge or no charge, man.
Yeah. And powerlifting like demonstrates
and
that.
When you grab a barbell, we're not gonna go casual. We're gonna look for something to do about it. We're not just gonna, hey, oh man, I'm gonna do back today and I'm gonna get a back pump.
Yeah,
it's casual.
Yeah.
we're gonna grab a video game and we're gonna say I'm gonna be a competitive video gamer. We're gonna grab a tennis ball and we're gonna say na we're gonna be Wimbledon champs, motherfucker.
Yeah. I'm gonna be the prince of tennis.
Prince of tennis, and it's just inherent in our
attitude.
You literally
just go all out in
what
you do.
Yeah, it's just our attitude. That's why we get hurt. That's why we succeed. That's why we lose. That's why we win. It's either. I can't even. It's hard for me to say this because it's such a cliche. It's the go hard or go home mentality.
Yeah.
Sucks to hear it, but.
Yeah.
Some people have it. Some people don't.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it's lucky to have it. Sometimes it's a curse to have it.
As I've been telling Carlos a couple of days back, wanting everything to be done and wanting the best, going hard or going home, it's a gift and a curse, because people think that you're so brave for living, you're so great for living this life of being such a quote unquote perfectionist that you really go through with all of your goals. But you know, it comes with a price, because you have to sacrifice your social relationships, you have to sacrifice sleep, you have to sacrifice a lot of things.
It's like black swan in real life.
Exactly.
Yeah, my well.
Or maybe more, but yeah. But the point is, it's I don't bottom line, I don't blame people for not living that life. Because like, people forget that there is also a merit from being simple, from being content. And if someone is content with being normal, with being very, very middle of the road, with just being barely there, you know what? Good for that person. It doesn't matter. But it just so happens that me and Carlos, I don't know, I hope I can speak for you as well, that we just can't live that life.
You never settle for, I guess, quote unquote, mediocrity or
yeah, exactly. And you know, at least for myself, I'm not an excellent athlete. I'm not an excellent entrepreneur. I'm not an excellent everything. I have a lot of flaws. Of course we do. But this spirit, quote unquote, as cliche as it may sound, the spirit that I have is my greatest asset. And that's what I use to get the goals done. Because, of course, I have to work harder than those who have talent. But just because that I don't have that great talent doesn't mean I don't have a chance. Because having that heart, having that
grit,
hustle, is in itself, yeah, that itself is a talent. And not a lot of people have them.
What would I say? Something about talent doesn't work if talent doesn't work hard. Something like that, right? It's a basketball thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it rings true. It rings true, yeah.
Well, I mean, Kobe Bryant's like that. This guy, I would watch clips from him before. This guy would wake up 4 a.m. to train till 10 a.m. And after that, after probably, you know, eating and trying to meet his daily survival habits, he would train again at around, like, literally at 5 p.m. to, like, whenever. Like, this guy is crazy. And, yeah, I guess... You know, there's just their Mamba mentality. Like, yeah.
I don't know what that is. I always see it, but I don't understand what it means.
Okay, so Kobe Bryant's nickname is Black Mamba, which is like a snake in Africa, because okay, he's very stealth. That sounded wrong. That sounded wrong. But this other basketball player named him after a snake from Africa.
Poor name.
Because he strikes, he's fast, he's very calculating. And because he's obsessive about his art or his work, he got that name, the Mamba Mindset. That became a hashtag
that
or
became
whatever.
A thing.
That became a thing, yeah, yeah. And yeah, looking back, yeah, I guess that's what you guys are trying to be. Like being really good in your... in what you do, like, yeah, 110%, you know?
Yeah, and it's, well, two things. Just because you're, like, being 110% with it doesn't mean you should be stupid about it.
Yeah.
Like, of course, you have to be smart about it. You have to
work smart.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to work smart.
Yeah.
Because that's where efficiency goes. And you just want to get the most out of everything. Second, I don't discredit people when they say that. you know, it's useless to develop a skill that you absolutely have no talent at. And that's true. Sometimes you just have to accept that. Like for me, I know I can't be a painter. I can't draw for shit. When I was young, I would have homeworks for like draw your pet dog. Then you know who would draw my fucking homework? It's my mom, because I can't draw a dog.
Yeah.
So, but by the same token, people gravitate to the things that they do best. So if I gravitate towards strength sports, if I gravitate towards music production, if I gravitate towards marketing, that means I probably enjoy it, and I probably have a future for it. Like it, I'm not sure how great of a future that is, but I definitely have a shot at it.
Yeah.
So given that I have a shot at it, there is no logical choice for me except to give it my all, to give it my best, because that's the cards that have been.
That's the opportunity that you can build.
Yeah. Those are the cards that have been dealt to me by life. So, what should I just fold? Should I throw it away? I think that's the wrong mentality. So, it's really about just making the most of what you're given with. Yeah.
But you said this comes at a cost. This kind of obsessive mindset. Let's say, how do you deal with the things that you compromise for? Well,
of course,
focus.
For example, for loved ones, it's making sure that you're transparent with your goals. Like if you're gonna say to my parents, to my girlfriend, that hey, I have to be out on a Saturday for a racket, for a gig, so I can't make it, or I know this is Saturday and it's supposed to be like a relaxing day for us, but I have things to do. And it's more of just making that clear and being transparent about what your goals are. You don't say that, you don't say to the people that you love or the people that wait on you, like, oh, hey, you want to be part of this? Are you interested to join? No, you don't force it. If you know that you yourself will make things faster, will make things work, then start it yourself first. You don't have to like be fake, that you don't have to make a facade that you're doing things that you actually don't or you can't. Just be true to the people that you love, to the people that have relationships with you, and admit to yourself, admit to them that sometimes you cannot give them your time.
Yeah, just pure honesty.
Yeah. You don't say that, hey, I suck at time management because I should have given you time. No.
Just say, I have no time for this.
I have no time for this. It's just that plain and simple. And if you want to maintain that relationship, it's more of just making that person understand that this is the case. Of course, people, relationships matter and people matter. But at the time being, I'm not getting any younger.
Like, this is what I prioritize now.
Yeah, this is what I prioritize, and this is what has to be done for me to actually get going, for me to have a future. Because if I don't do this, chances are I will never do this.
Yeah. And were you always like this since you were younger? Like very hyper focused?
Carlos is laughing his ass, and I think he wants to say something about my childhood.
Yeah,
and
knowing
how
that you're Migs' friend, Carlos, is there something that you want to share?
Miguel is the most stubborn mind that I know. I have this story that keeps popping up in my head whenever I think of Miguel and his childhood. So when we were in grade school, right? Grade school, I would go to Miguel's house and eat dinner because we were recording new wave songs that sadly never got out.
Yeah.
So he doesn't eat at school. He eats at home and then goes home and eat dinner.
Same,
he never
man.
Eats.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat at school as well before. Yeah,
he never eats, and he saves up his lunch money. He was saving up, and he's not even poor. He's not that poor. We weren't that poor. He saves up money for 2 years. Yeah. He saved up his lunch money for 2 years as a grade school. How much discipline would you need as a teen? Not even a teen, preteen to save up money. How neurotic could you be?
How many lunch times do you have to skip?
Yeah. How could you stand as a child not to eat when everyone else is eating? You have to be mad. You have to be driven.
Yeah.
You have to be really obsessive.
Yeah.
And Miguel was that kind of person. He was teaching guitar lessons to kids and commuting everywhere in Las Piñas just so he can save up money for recording equipment. As a grade school
student,
preteen, whatever, 11-year-old, he was even 13, teaching guitar lessons, not eating lunch, saving up money
at
that age.
God.
Damn, just to get recording equipment at 13 years old. That doesn't make sense to me. It
wouldn't even occur to my head.
It doesn't make sense. It's crazy.
Trying to do a side hustle and like all that.
Who does that?
Yeah.
And it carried over. It developed to even more neuroticism.
Yeah.
More obsessiveness.
Yeah.
He's here now with the recording studio and whatever, a band.
But how about you? Like, was there like a wake up call or like some kind of striking moment that made you to who you are, that's just as driven as Miguel? Or
Miguel and I are very cut from, even though we're kind of the same, we're very, very different in the sense that I'm as happy-go-lucky as I can be. I can wake up one day in another country and I wouldn't mind. Miguel would freak out. Why am I driven? Because I know that there's nowhere else to go. I would consider myself alone. I would consider Miguel my family, to be honest. It's kind of sad, but it's kind of not. My dad was a very, very stubborn bum who drained out cash from the family. Usual old rich kind of people that doesn't work ever. Yeah. My dad didn't work a day in his life. And it was like, growing up, my father was a role model. Then when I was older, he became like, I want to become the exact opposite of him.
Right.
Yeah. It stemmed from that, I think. The fear of failure really drives me. The fear of being mediocre really drives me. The fear of being left out is what kills me the most. I don't want to be like my dad, the bum that just leached on his mom and stuff.
That's like your goal, like not to be.
I want to be the exact opposite of him. At 17 years old, I was earning my own money and I never looked back. I didn't, even 100 pesos, I didn't ask for any of that. And that's what drives me.
Wow. Props.
Bigot.
Sorry for making the mood so heavy, but that's life.
That's life!
C'est la vie. Earlier on, as you were talking about heartbreaks as being the fire or the fuel to the fire, I actually have a really close friend who's my partner for my fitness brand, the Iron Bison.
He has an apparel line, by the way.
I'm establishing. I'm working on it. So I have a partner for this venture, and at least a year ago, literally a year or slightly more than a year ago, he experienced like a very bad heartbreak. He got cheated on like more than damn, twice. So
sucks, bro.
More than twice.
With the same girl?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Okay, so at that time, can I just say at that time he was pretty fat. Like he had the belly. He used to work out before he got into that previous relationship, but yeah, he lost so much. He gained so much. And after he broke up, as soon as that happened, he just started working out. He would like cycle to the gym every like 4 a.m. and he would live off sweet potatoes and fish. Like after that, then fast forward to more than a year and a half, he's a physical trainer now at Fitness First. Like from literally like he really looked like a bum like more than a year ago, and now he's like he's actually a competitive bodybuilder. He recently joined.
Ew.
He recently back in December he recently joined a contest for Mutant Mass. Yeah.
Damn. That's
so
sick.
Yeah. It was at World Trade. He wasn't like one of the top 10, but you know,
that was a big feat.
I was so proud of him. Like from this guy who had the big belly, who looked like a bum, to like literally a bodybuilder, a tanned bodybuilder. damn, that transformation was big. You know, like, it's amazing what heartbreaks can do for you, I guess, for
definitely,
some people.
Definitely.
Yeah, I remember myself, like, I had a similar story, but it wasn't really involved with fitness because I was too young to discover fitness. But I remember I was 15, if I'm correct. Yeah, I was 15 and I got heartbroken. You know what happened after?
What?
I made my first album. It was a 12 song album for a band that it was called De Morgan. It was a mixture of thrash metal and death metal. So I had writer's block back when I was in a relationship. But as soon as I got out, like, all of the lyrics came and all of the riffs came. And then I shredded. It was a great album, it was still one of my favorite landmarks for my life because I always told myself, like, I'm not even 18 and I wrote songs, I mixed, I mastered, although it wasn't that great of quality, but I was the Filipino Varg. So I produced that album and we played shows. And this was before I was 18. And the funny thing was, like, that was the drive. I didn't have the drive after before that heartbreak. Although, I should say that it only happened once. Like, after that episode, like, heartbreak wasn't really, it wasn't a big thing in my life anymore. Like, now the motivation is more of just, it's actually my age.
You grew up.
No, I don't mean it that way. I mean it like, I have a sense.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I have a sense of urgency that I only have 10 years to live. No, I don't have. I'm sure I have more.
That mindset.
But that's my mindset. Like, I'm not scared to die, but I'm scared to not have lived
a full life.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So since I feel I'm only 24. But I already feel that my age. I mean, that may sound stupid to a lot of people who are older than me. What the fuck are you saying? You're so young, dude. But yeah, I feel my age, and like the most of the things that I want to do, I feel that I can only do them within the next 10 years. Then my physical health, maybe not my physical health, even maybe my mental health, my emotional health. I don't know what's gonna happen to me. So. As while I'm young, while I'm strong, and while I can do this, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna do it well. That's what I have to do. At least that's what I say to myself.
Going back to that heartbreak story of yours, I was thinking that the first heartbreak is the biggest one, right? It's like,
yeah,
a big life event.
Yeah, because it's like your first.
I feel as though that stuff like that, heartbreak, people dying, your first kiss. Our impetus, sis, is that if that's a word, like big life
milestones.
Events with a surge of raw emotion coming, is what jolts you into action. I think it wakes you up, heartbreak, someone dying, and it's great to think about how it kickstarts your life from being just passive. I'm sure that guy with the big belly was a passive.
Oh,
life,
I saw it firsthand how. Like how before he was kind of working out, then he constantly just gained weight.
It's great to think about it that life events gives you life.
It gives you life.
Yeah, it gives you life. You're not just only living, but
it gives you that ball of electricity, I guess. Or
you're no longer just existing.
Yeah.
So I'm happy for heartbreaks, and I'm sure Miguel is too.
Yeah.
Good job, girls. You broke our hearts.
Yeah, I remember one of our friends, I won't name him, but he always told me that he looks forward to funerals. Then I asked, why do you look forward to funerals? Because he told me, there are a lot more things that we talk about that have a meaning in life when we talk in funerals more than we talk in birthdays. So he told me, I don't like going to birthdays because we don't talk about anything meaningful. But when I go to funerals, we always talk about something meaningful.
Like the shit that counts or the things that matter. That's when it gets brought up in those.
And come to think of it, like that's when my I kind of agree. Now, when people have birthdays, like, of course I want to be there, but if I'm not, like, too close, I just think of it like, they're gonna, after the hangover, after a few weeks,
it's passing.
It's done.
Yeah.
But, like, for example, a wedding, a funeral, things that really are milestones. Hell, like a grand opening of my friend's business, that even means more than a birthday because it's a milestone. It's something that can change people's lives. Weddings change people's lives. Yeah. So that's, now I know where to prioritize my time when going to events. It's like going to those events instead of going to birthdays, going to gatherings. Because, well, as much as alcohol can contribute to a very, very fruitful conversation, it's still the...
Yeah, in terms of the substance.
Yeah, the substance may not be there. Like, hell, I get to talk about more meaningful things doing this podcast than going out drinking.
Yeah, no, I must admit, yeah.
Yeah, and this itself is a very good therapy for me.
Like, this is something that I wouldn't really talk about at like 1 a.m. with, you know, like drinking at a bar or, you know... Like, or,
yeah, but you know, I've learned a lot of stuff. Even we've only been 3 episodes long, I've learned a lot of stuff and reflected. Because after this is done, I'm gonna listen to it, not because I'm vain, but because I have to. But I'm gonna listen to it, and I'm gonna enjoy it. And later when I sleep, I'm gonna reflect. Like, you know, I learned something today. Mm-hmm. Remember last episode when you talked about making, I think it was Deggs, he said something about making versions of yourself, like
filters.
Yeah. So instead of having masks for people, you just put filters. That way you're still authentic. Like, that's such a novel concept to me that I wouldn't even think if I was alone. But that's very smart.
Yeah.
You do that. You do that. It's filters. You just filter out your actions.
You tone down
you polish yourself a little
bit. Or you
bit.
Max it up.
Yeah, it's not a mask. It's just a little bit of polish and rubbing. Crazy.
I don't know if this is like a... Anyway, good analogy. Like, for example, if you were to get... You get sick. You have a fever, right? At that moment, you forget all the petty shit that you go through. And that's when you focus on like shit that really matters, right? You getting... You know, some getting sick. Any like, I don't know, frightening encounter, that's the time that when you really
Dude,
like
food poisoning changes your life.
Yeah.
Food poisoning will change your
like
life.
Like you zone in.
Like you're 3 days sick and like 48 out of your 72 hours are spent in the toilet, then your asshole is just like sore as a, it's just so red. It's like a cherry.
It's redder than a chicken tikka masala.
Yeah. Then you're drained emotionally, physically, you can't eat.
You forget gossip. You forget about people talking shit about you.
Because you only talk about your shit now.
Yeah,
you're
talking about your shit. Your own shit. You only give your own shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you actually give a shit for giving a shit.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Literally.
I forgot what they're called. But we studied this in philosophy. It was from Marcel. I forgot his first name even. But Gabriel Marcel. It's called, I forgot. But technically, there are events in people's lives that change the way they think and make them reflective. So these are the most important parts of a person's life, he says at least.
Shitting in the toilet for 72 hours.
Yes, dude. Like, that's no joke. I'm sure anyone who has experienced like amoebiasis.
Oh my goodness. I don't want to experience that.
Yeah, that's a shitter.
That's actually interesting that how you brought up that philosophical thing about, I guess, earth-shattering events to that person. I've witnessed that with some people, like how back in high school they're so chill and very, I wouldn't say easygoing, but they were very different. But come college, you couldn't imagine how they turned out to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like I've seen that with quite a few people, you know?
I've seen a lot of those because our of course I'm not gonna name names and I'm not gonna name schools.
Yeah.
Just guess where I actually had high school, but most of our top students, like the what do you call it? gold honors, silver honors. I don't know what I forgot.
Gold star. Yeah.
Valedictorians, salutatorians. Yeah. They were actually the people, I think one of them, I'm not going to name who, hasn't graduated yet. And the other one is changed schools 3 times. And funny fact, our drummer, who was never an excellent student, was the first one to graduate of all the batch, among all the batch. He was the first one to graduate, first one to work. And he was like top 20 out of 25. Yeah. See?
Yeah.
It those things really don't matter. But come to think about it, it's really, really ironic that...
It is.
It is ironic, right?
I have a very funny story about that, actually. Since I was in first year high school, I had summer classes with math, Araling Panlipunan, which is history for all y'all folks. That's math, history, science. Basically, every subject, not including English. I had to take summer classes for it because I flunked every subject except English and PE. I was even in danger of flunking art. Can you believe that? I was that stupid. And everyone from my high school and grade school that was people that didn't want me to copy their assignments and stuff. All of them are either pregnant, still struggling with college, or a bum waiting for money to grab beer from his mom.
Yeah.
And it's like my biggest F you to everyone that was like not bullying me or stuff like that. Making fun of me when I didn't understand what algebra or MDAS is.
Oh, like they were condescending towards you.
Yeah, everyone was.
Oh,
and I hate those. It's funny right now when we see each other around Las Piñas and like, oi, what are you doing now, man?
What's
up? I'm working at Mang Inasal. And I'm like, fuck you,
okay,
man.
Okay, guys, he just made a middle finger to them doubters.
In itself, it's rewarding because what my dad said about it rang true. Like, it doesn't matter, it's just numbers. What you do in grade school, high school, these are just numbers. It's just like things that doesn't even matter in the long run. Why would you want to excel in school when life isn't like that?
And this is why...
Sorry, Macy.
Yeah. And this is why I'm so proud of like my closest friends. Because back in grade school, back in high school, we were categorically labeled as bums. We were bums.
Yeah, like people,
like people wouldn't even imagine where we would be at right now. For example, I have a friend like similar to your story. She was like, she would come to class back in high school drunk. She wouldn't even bother coming to class. Sometimes she would just cut classes back in high school, but. She was the first to graduate in our batch in college, you know, doing what she did. She studied filmmaking.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, like mad props to you. And now she's doing culinary now. She plans to open up her food stall. And like all
that's really good. That's really nice.
All these things, apparently high school teachers were like, I did not see this coming. And she was like, fuck yeah. And same with other people who were condescending towards her. And and for me, for example, people thought back in high school that I would be a bum, a guy who likes to constantly likes to drink out.
Wait. Yeah. What was your like image when you were in high school? Why was that the given future for you?
I'll admit, I was a party animal / procrastinator / slacker.
Party animal.
Yeah. So people would give me. People thought that I wouldn't go. I would go nowhere. Basically, that's what they thought. So, yeah, back in college, for me, it wasn't a big deal anyway. But like, I became so focused in college that I would get a lot of dean's list or whatnot, and people thought, you know, I was a I literally wouldn't achieve anything.
You wouldn't amount to anything.
Yeah, they would just say they'd probably see me somewhere at a bar getting wasted. And looking back, I'm like, well, you guys called that wrong. You know, you guys were wrong about that. And you know, I wouldn't rub it in their faces, but
no,
like,
of course. Well, anyway. Sometimes those people who give out those impressions about you, there could be some people who are legitimately concerned.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I can't believe Ira is just going to be like...
I did not get that though. It wasn't that kind of tone.
Oh, so they're just really...
Yeah, like looked down. They straight up frowned upon, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just hating.
Like deep down, like you could tell. They were subtle about it, but like you can tell how they were judging me.
That's the word I'm looking for. Judging you.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I think that's the worst. The most subtle kind of... I'd rather have someone who's upfront about it rather than someone who's like... Yeah.
Well, especially if they're your quote-unquote friends.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. I mean, if your friends are like that, then you should take care. Yeah. Because, well, this is the same thing that I tell Carlos, that I don't believe in people who have a lot of friends.
Yeah.
Because you can only have like maybe 10 at most.
It's like Facebook. Like you have, there's someone who has 2,000 friends.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. Like your real friends, like actual friends, are maybe a handful.
Yeah, like people who know your shit and like people would actually not share your secrets, and you can be comfortable with them talking about like your low points in life. I think those are the real.
Yeah, those are the real kind of people. Like, you can bring them anywhere. Like, you can give them any food. You can talk to them about anything and they'll accept you for who you are.
Yeah.
It's not because, you know, like, in this day of age, it's more of making connections, making acquaintances.
Yeah, which we brought up in the previous episode,
right?
Yeah.
And I don't blame you if you're an entrepreneur, if you work for that style, for that lifestyle. But if you're...
In terms of friendships.
Yeah, you just cannot say that they're your friends, plain and simple. They're not your friends. They're your connections. Those are two different things.
Yeah, one is just more practical rather than, I guess, genuine of like connecting with a person. Yeah. Establishing, a meaningful relationship with a person.
Not to shit on other people, but the same way that I know a couple of people who have like a lot of groups. So this is not just one group. For example, I have a group interested in this lifestyle, group of 10, another group of 10, another group of 10. Then they have different cliques. Then they say that all of them are their friends. But the caveat is, do they actually know each other? Like group one, group A and group B? No, they won't go together. So if you actually have to discriminate between your groups, then isn't that something that's already off? Like you're already grouping people that you already know that can't meet each other. Then they're probably not really your friends. They're more of like a social group.
Circle.
Yeah, a circle that you actually are just part of. But these are not your friends.
Like you couldn't mix them up.
You couldn't mix them up. And that I just think, this is just me, that is an indicator that they are not really your friends. If you can't hook up one friend to another and you're scared of that, I don't know why you would be scared of that. That just means that they're not your friends, that you're not comfortable with them, that you're afraid that people will judge you for your other friends.
But is it really about them judging you, or is it just more like you're concerned about how they would mesh? Because as you said, they have different lifestyles.
Well, yeah. But by the same token, if you're only friends with a person because of one lifestyle, could you actually say that person is your friend?
Yeah. Of course. No, no.
Because for example, if Carlos meshes with me and you mesh with me, then I guess you could also mesh.
Because we're not bound
by our lifestyle. We're bound by friendship.
Yeah.
And of course, for us, we're also bound by friendship, not by lifestyle. It's not because like, hey, Carlos is my teammate. Ira is my business partner. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Of course, if I put it that way, it won't work. But the truth is, you're not just my business partner. You're my friend. We've been friends.
We knew each other for years. Yeah.
And Carlos has been my friend since I was young.
Hmm.
And that connection itself is already meaningful. But my point is, there are definitely people who go out, hey, like in Filipino terms, hey, punta lang ako sa tropa number letter A. So there is tropa A, tropa B. Like
troop, platoon.
Tropa means troop or group. So it's like, okay, I have group A, I have group B, I have group C. See? So usually, at least from my observation, the only bonding that these people get is when they go to like, hey, inum tayo, let's go out drink.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
What do you do with your tropa, with your group? Yeah. We drink.
Yeah, like you, I guess you bond on vices or whatever.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Okay. But then that's what I mean when I cannot see them as actual friends.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, I'm sure some people are like getting hurt or getting angry, but this is just me, and I really just think that there is only a handful of people that you can consider friends.
Like if you're not the kind of person who I don't mind chilling out with at breakfast or lunch,
yeah,
like
dude,
for an entire day, then chances are we're not like-minded individuals. And
yeah, if you constantly have to small talk, like we talk about
yeah.
last episode, if you have to constantly small talk a person just to not get him leave your house or get away or like do anything else, I'm here. Like if I could stay here in Pao's room, like we don't have to talk.
Talk to each other.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's okay. It wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
We wouldn't mind. And I think that means a lot when it comes to friendship. It's a good indicator.
Yeah, like you're comfortable in silence.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But isn't that like telling about our society? I don't want to generalize, but do you think Filipino society, do we live in a very cliquish kind of society? Like based on our age group, the 20s, you know, millennial age group. Clicky. Based from our experiences anyway.
I guess Carlos can answer this because he has a lot more acquaintances than I do.
What was the question?
In our age group, is our society, for our age group, is our like society very clicky?
I would say so. That
based from our experiences.
Yeah,
your experiences. Yeah.
Very clicky. I think it would stem from high school, grade school, college life seeping through real life
that carried on.
It carried on, and it took on its own cultural
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
And I think it stems from just the fear of being alone, fear of being alone again. Yeah. Like you would rather be mindless and clicky and stubborn and superficial than just be comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
You would rather talk about your golf club or your lifting club or your Forever 21 club, whatever, and then just be alone and read a book or listen to an album. You have to spend your days, your free time, filling out the holes in your life.
The gaps.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just being too deep or... But I think it's that. Everyone is lonely inside. It's just how you manage it.
But question is loneliness a bad thing in the first place? Because can't you enjoy your solitude?
Yeah, I do. I think that's what most people our age don't understand, is the contrast of life. In a way, they try to block out the pain and the sadness and the loneliness. And they don't understand that it's a circle and it keeps spinning. And you can't appreciate the good things when you don't go through the bad things. It's like super rich Ayala people only having good times, and then they go crazy when life happens. Go ahead.
Honestly, can I say something? This is a bit of a rant. Like, I eat alone when I eat out, like sometimes. Like, I would just eat alone. And waitresses would give me a funny look, like when I say table for one. Like, sir, are you okay?
No shit.
I was like, yeah, I just want to eat. Like,
yeah, I'm just hungry.
Yeah, and based from my friends, we actually had a conversation. This was back in college. She'd be like, oh, I don't want to eat alone, man. I don't want to eat alone, man. I don't want to have lunch by myself. I'm like, why? What's the big deal?
Yeah, I don't
you just go
that.
There to eat. I don't get it. Like, I wouldn't watch a cinema alone. I don't know. Like, for me,
why not?
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal because I'm just like having fun and just doing my own thing.
Yeah, why can't I just walk inside the mall and just walk alone?
Yeah, so one time I went to Savory. I'm not going to state which branch. I got a table for one and they were like, sir, like next time you should bring someone with you.
Maybe the waitress was flirting with you. You wouldn't know.
Yeah, but like... That was one incident, okay? But there were so many. That was a notable incident, and I was like ordering. Oh, I want. I'm gonna order this, and I ordered like a big, big set of like a big set of food. And they were like, "Sir, are you okay?" Like, "Yeah, I'm hungry."
I'm not okay because I'm hungry now, but like,
and you piss me off.
Yeah, and you piss me off.
But yeah, that was the word. Those were the words that I was looking for a while ago. It was trying to become something part, trying to be
the sense of belonging,
part of something, otherwise. something bigger than yourself. Otherwise, yeah. But you know, there's nothing bad about that. If you just come to terms with your sadness, if you come to terms with your loneliness, then you accept you. Yeah, we're all technically we're born alone, die alone, di ba?
You're
born alone, you die alone, and that's life.
That's a fact of
life. Yeah, you can't do anything about it. But if you need companionship, for sure, go on. But you don't have to be a people pleaser just for the sake of it. Like, you have to be yourself. That's why you create genuine connections with people, is because people like you for who you are.
Who match your values.
And you actually have meaning conversations. You share meaningful life events. You learn from each other.
Yeah.
This is not like a social club where you have to make sure that people like you. That's a problem with, then again, it as Carlos said, it bleeds from the high school lifestyle that you have to be part of some sort of like a troop, a gang, to actually be relevant, because you're such a small entity, like you're such a insignificant person.
You're a speck in the universe. You're a speck of dust. Yeah.
Like in the social world, you're such a powerless being that you have to become. You have to be part of a group just to make something happen. But what happens is, what are you outside of the group? You become your group. You don't become yourself. You don't become a group of selves. Sorry, I don't know how to word this, but you want to become a group of selves.
You replicate the norm. Yeah. I guess of
so
those people.
What is better is you are in a group, but you are individuals in a group. You are not a group that is just like a direct representation of the group.
Like, we constantly like feel the need to associate ourselves with people.
So you identify with yourself. You don't identify with the group. Yeah, because you have a loss of individuality. So I think that's very sad that people, I mean, it's human nature and people really fall to those.
We compromise our individuality.
Yeah, I mean,
the social setting.
Going back again, it's just because of our need to belong and our need to find ourselves. But we should, as Carlos said, we should be comfortable in our own skin.
I think it also stems from, I don't know if I'm reaching out here, but it comes from this tribal mentality that goes back ages, that you couldn't survive by yourself in the wild. Like, and it just evolved from there, I would
say.
We're
social creatures. Yeah. I guess that's how we're wired to be as, anyway.
The hunter-gatherer tribe.
Yeah, but by the same token, we are social creatures, and for us to be happy, I strongly believe that we have to have genuine social connections.
Yes.
Not meaningless tribes. Yeah. Like, genuine, good conversations that don't always require alcohol and drugs to be meaningful. Just like this podcast.
Preach! But I'm starting to notice a pattern. I think the people that we're closest to are the ones who have seen us grow up. Like, literally from childhood.
Yeah.
Based from my experience, and I'm pretty sure based on you guys. Yeah.
Yeah, but hey, don't get us wrong. Like, we've been friends here, at least specifically in this village, for maybe 3 years, 4 years. Then I left the village. Then I went to a different village. Then I've never seen him again. But what the funny thing is, this was the age of the computer shop. You know, when computer shops were being a very thing.
Oh, it's past 1 hour.
Being a very big thing.
Pay
yeah.
up 20 pesos.
So now it's like, before it was an R for like 50 pesos.
Yeah.
Utopia days. Then at the boom, like the age of the computer shop boom, it became like 100 for 3 Rs. And everybody was like, really? You can pay 100 bucks for 3 Rs? Okay, hook me up. So when I changed villages, I went to this computer shop that offered the best promos, of course, because I was a cheapskate, because I was young. Then I saw this fat kid who sort of looked like someone I knew. Then I approached him. Hey, don't I know you?
Oi!
Hey, I know you. So yeah, we reconnected, and ever since, everything just came became.
He started going to that computer shop daily just so we can exchange YouTube links of The Cure and The Smiths.
Yeah, so we were that type of people. So you see, like I actually made it the point, and I'm sure he did, to actually visit the computer shop at least once a week, just so that we could bond.
It was by choice.
Yeah. So, I guess it's not just the amount of time, but the quality of time.
Mm.
Like I'm sure if you got stuck with a dude, like both of you were captured by ISIS, then you didn't know anyone else, and you both had to like come up with an escape plan. Right?
9/11 was spring.
See, if you had to come up with an escape plan, like to get out of that like ISIS shit. See, like I'm sure after that ordeal, you'd become like best friends, because that's such a
you guys bonded.
Yeah, that's such a shitty but like extreme bonding experience. But if you like, you maintain a group of friends because you drink together, you smoke together, you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's. Like, even if you had a smoking partner since, like, provided that babies can smoke.
Yeah.
Like, if babies could smoke and you had one smoking partner for the rest of your life, I'm pretty sure it just didn't want to be close.
Yeah.
You just would know, like, what his favorite cigarette is, how he smokes, how he lights, how long, how many sticks. But that's it.
But do you think the best friendships are formed at the shittiest moments, whether that's based on the individuals?
For sure. Not because that it builds the friendships, but because it presents adversity.
It's the catalyst or what?
Yeah, because it presents adversity. What I mean by that is, for example, I'm going to give you a hypothetical scenario. Let's say that me and Carlos did something very, very illegal, whatever that is.
And you guys were in the same cell.
Yeah, no. And we got caught. And deep inside, I know that I was the mastermind. If I was a shitty person, I would say, no, he did it. He did it. So you would already know your friendship if you were tested in a very, very bad time. Because that's when the truth of
nature,
your
true
nature
colors
comes out.
Yeah.
And how much you value the person.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the boat is sinking, who will you save? It's just the same thing.
If the plane's crashing, who would you give the parachute to? Yeah.
That's why I think the bad times are very meaningful, because it tests friendship. It doesn't actually build it. It tests. Because if your friendship isn't tested yet and there comes a very bad time, chances are that friendship can break then and there.
Yeah, instantly.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to business, because I've heard so many stories of people getting screwed over by their so-called best friends.
For sure.
And I think, yeah, as you said, I think it's a red flag. I guess if you're...
It's a red flag if my business partner steals my money. Yeah.
I mean, it's a red flag, I guess, if your friendship has not been tested. You know what I mean?
Well, in a way. Yeah, of course, because I couldn't even imagine a friendship...
Because you don't get a heads up about, oh, what is this person like?
Yeah, I couldn't even imagine a friendship that hasn't been tested yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, like...
Like, it's like the requisite. I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah. It's very hard to fathom a friendship that hasn't been tested. Yeah, otherwise, that's just an acquaintance or like any basic social relationship for one purpose or
like
another.
Like if you were to go to the principal's office and both of you are in trouble, you wouldn't just drop him, leave him hanging there.
Yeah.
But you'd be like, yeah, I'll go with you. I'll take
this.
I'll take it in, you know?
Yeah.
Then after that, you'll talk about how shitty that moment was and laugh.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But from then on,
even like, for example, I'd go back to, I'm sure there are phases in our life where we were like grade schoolers. Then we'd done some very, very shitty thing with some other friend. Then you would go to the principal's office. Then you, for example, you'd be like four friends. Then one of them would be the fucking rat.
The snitch.
Yeah, the snitch. Yeah. After that ordeal, like that person is an entirely different entity from the three of you left. But because of that same instance, now the three of you have this special bond. Like, you know, okay, this person has my back. I can go to the next step and give more trust to this person. Because given the test of those tests, like, this person does well. He performs well. And I can say that he is my friend.
Mm. But for those people who've, like, broken the trust of that friendship, do you think there's a chance for reconciling or redeeming? Or it's like you won't look at the person the same way ever? Or...
Well, I guess for this aspect, it really depends on the person and the situation.
It's on the person.
Yeah, right? it's a very context-based thing.
Mm. Very subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was an amazing discussion. I mean, we came from just the kitchen life and now we're into like value of relationships.
Yeah. From talking about Thai cuisine to this, to building trusts with people.
Yeah.
It's been a very interesting episode.
Yeah, very interesting episode. Carlos, thank you very much for this episode. Any final words?
Final remarks, Carlos?
Thanks for having me, guys. I enjoyed the time.
Actually, thanks for having us. Because we're recording at his house, guys.
Yeah, come by anytime. I'm good.
So, yeah. See you again in the next podcast, I guess. So, this is the third episode of our very much loved podcast. We give our best here. We give almost our everything to make this happen.
Yeah.
So imagine waking up on a Sunday just to do this. You know
on
that
a
you
Sunday
love
morning.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that you love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I'm Migs.
This is Ira.
And this is Where We Are.